The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure, along with my co-chair, Mark Weinberg, to open this very special session to look at the 25 years since the first cases of AIDS were described. This is a session to really do a look over the 25 years, looking at the contribution of science, of policy, of programs, of the community, and of people living with HIV/AIDS to the response to this pandemic. So it's my pleasure, along with Mark, to welcome you here, and I'll turn it over to Mark to say a couple of words.
As we witness that we are all here together 25 years after the first case descriptions of HIV disease came out in the literature, we recognize that we still have a long way to go. We also recognize that the next years will hopefully bring us closer to our dreams of both providing even better and cheaper drugs for the treatment of all those infected by HIV than we have managed thus far. And of course, and above all, that we will succeed in our goal of bringing HIV drug access to everyone in the world at need, regardless of ability to pay. Without further ado, we introduce Dr. Richard Horton, the editor-in-chief of Lancet, who will now preside over this session.
Thank you so much, Mark, Helene. Welcome. Thank you for coming for what will be not just an important session, but the most important session of this meeting. So I want you all to stay. You're not allowed to leave. We're just over halfway through this conference now. We've celebrated, we've protested, we've shouted, we've cried, we've applauded, and we've been astounded by what we've heard. But now we're beginning to get serious. We have some serious questions to ask about what we're doing. Why is it that we're not using these unique gatherings more as a global accountability mechanism for country progress? To hold every one of us accountable for the part that we should be playing in defeating HIV/AIDS, and to set specific, measurable objectives for the next 2 years. Why is it that we are still ignoring the broader health, economic, social, and cultural context of HIV/AIDS, seeing it as a health crisis rather than what it is, a human crisis? Why is it that we are still being lectured at, rather than listening to and debating with those living with and leading with HIV/AIDS? Why is Africa still so marginalized in our discussions about AIDS? Why does our definition of science still seem to extend only to the laboratory experiments and the clinical trial? Why do we see biology, medicine, epidemiology, social science, and policy as mutually exclusive tracks, reinforcing divisions rather than creating new alliances? Why do we not see community as a powerful instrument for societal change? Why are NGOs still not being given the credit that they deserve as vital levers in the global AIDS response? After 25 years, why are children still being ignored? And why is it that we flinch from admitting that there is still not a genuine global commitment to scale up our response to HIV/AIDS? We are lucky today because every one of those 10 questions is going to be answered by our panel of speakers. We're going to begin with Tony Fauci, who is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, a position he has occupied since 1984. and in which role he has gained a unique insight and perspective on the scientific challenges posed by this pandemic. Tony.
Thank you, Richard, for that kind introduction. I hear you, I understand what you're saying, and I will deliver your message. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon to discuss one component of our efforts, our global efforts, namely the scientific response to HIV, in the context of reflecting back and looking forward in 25 years of HIV/AIDS. Now, it's virtually impossible to do this completely in the 7 minutes that I've been given, but I want to highlight one or two important points and then come with some thoughts about the future. I think anyone who was around at the time will not forget that extraordinary week in the summer of 1981 when we first became aware of the unusual occurrence of pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in 5 gay men in Los Angeles, followed quickly thereafter the next month with indications of Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis not only in California but in New York. What's transcribed from that time over the period of 25 years has gone beyond the imagination of anyone, including myself at the time, for we are now witnessing what is historically clearly one of the most important pandemics that our civilization has ever been confronted with. You know the numbers, so I need not dwell on them. What about the scientific response? An amazing more than 200,000 HIV-related papers have been published as of a couple of days ago since the beginning of those first two Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reports. And within those publications are some striking and almost breathtaking scientific accomplishments. This is a list of them, and again, obviously, I can't go through each and every one of them, but they span everything from the initial profound observation of the epidemic in its form without a cause to leading up to understanding the etiological agent, going through differences of patterns throughout the world, as well as pathogenesis treatment, and the big obstacle we face now is with vaccines. I think when one looks historically and you look at the transforming scientific accomplishments, no one can deny that the events in 1983 and 84 with the discovery of HIV as the causative agent by Luc Montagnier and Bob Gallo was the beginning of opening up a scientific door that led to the rapid-fire discovery of scientific questions and answers that have transformed how we now look at HIV. One of the most important of these occurred literally less than a year following the discovery of HIV, and that was the development of a blood test which not only had the implications of protecting the blood supply, but informed us of the frightening prevalence of this infection, namely the demonstration of the extent of asymptomatic disease, something that continues to confound us even to this day. And then there were other scientific advances, the unraveling of the organization of the HIV virion, the mapping and ultimate sequencing of the 9 genes, 3 structural and 6 regulatory of HIV. And it should be noted that even at this conference, we are still hearing more about understanding the function of many of these genes. The replication cycle of HIV, first understanding the initial CD4 receptor and then the chemokine receptors, whose dual binding led to the exposure of epitopes, which now and in the future will have profound impact on how we look at vaccines and our ability to elicit neutralizing antibodies. The studies in the mid and early 90s of understanding the dynamics of HIV infection, with its striking and frightening replication of billions of virions a day, together with the dynamics of lymphocyte turnover, and the interesting issue of the establishment of reservoirs, which have really confounded us in our ability to eliminate or eradicate HIV. So now when you talk about scientific advances and you talk about the practicality, none stands higher than the development of effective treatments for HIV-infected individuals. Understanding the different targets with historically first reverse transcriptase inhibitor with the 1986 studies on AZT, 10 years later with the protease inhibitors leading to the regimens of combination, which from the mid-90s until today have transformed how we treat HIV-infected individuals. And newer targets like fusion inhibitors, and as discussed at this meeting, integrase and maturation inhibitors tell us that we do have a robust pipeline, but that we need to continue that robust pipeline. In the United States alone, the FDA has approved more than 25 drugs for HIV, and it's the same for regulatory authorities throughout the world. The results have been profound. If you take one sampling of an example, a paper last month in the JID indicated that with the AIDS drugs used, together with the treatment and prevention of opportunistic infections, there have been more than 3 million years of life saved in the United States alone. But that's where we start getting in trouble, because that is not enough. And the reason it's not enough is that a large portion of the world has still not yet gotten the advantage of those scientific advances. This slide says that of December, there were 1.3 million people receiving ARVs. Just this morning, the announcement is that there's 1.6 million, or 25% of the people who need it. We are still 75% away from where we need to be when we're talking about getting drugs to those who need it. Prevention. The bottom line message of this slide is that prevention is not unidimensional. There is no one component of prevention that is going to give us the solution to the problem. And it ranges from clean syringes and exchanging needle programs, circumcisions, the distribution of condoms, topical microbicides, and others. So no way can you say that one and only one way is going to be the answer to prevention. In my last minute or so, what about looking forward to the future? Key scientific challenges. The persistence of the viral reservoir, an area that myself and my own lab have been working on now for some years, confounding our ability to eradicate. This will be the challenge for the next several years. The early events in HIV infection, particularly the impact on the gut, the major lymphoid organ, new targets for drugs, and obviously and importantly, topical microbicides and vaccines. I must spend at least a few seconds on topical microbicides because, as we all know and have heard at this conference, HIV/AIDS is progressively taking on the face of a woman. And it is absolutely essential that we address the special concerns of women in allowing them to protect themselves if their partners do not use male condoms, and in which abstinence is just not feasible for their situation in life. And the events of the future and the resources of the future will be progressively more dedicated to microbicides. Vaccine is clearly the last great holy grail of scientific accomplishments, and our inability to have a vaccine at this point relates to some fundamental scientific problems that we don't have time to go into. So in summary, the basic and clinical research findings over the last 25 years have actually been breathtaking in their extent and in their impact. They are the foundation for the application of these findings to the treatment, prevention, and care. And although we can say that the scientific response is a success story, in the same breath, we must remember that history will judge us as a global community by what we do with these scientific advances in the next 25 years, as much as by what we have accomplished in the first 25 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. We now move to Peter Piot, Executive Director of UNAIDS since 1994. A stellar public health scientist, Peter's worked extensively in Africa, bringing to bear first-hand field experience to his role in the hallowed halls of the UN. Peter, come and talk to us.
Thank you, Richard, and good morning, everybody. It's fair to say that in a quarter of a century, in 25 years, AIDS has made it to one of the make-or-break issues of our time. It is now in an altogether different league, the league of global change, of climate change, of massive poverty, of chronic armed conflicts, and a disease we had not even heard of 25 years ago has made it as the first cause of death for men and women under 60 in the world. There is no precedent for that in our recent history. And the history of AIDS is also a history of globalization, but not globalization of markets and profits, but it's a globalization of an epidemic, and it tells a story of globalization of human behavior and networks, because every single individual living with HIV is connected to all other persons living with HIV, and that is the existential meaning of the movement of people living with HIV, I believe. Looking at the spread of HIV, the globalization of it, I'll show you three slides. The first one, you see here how in 85 it was mostly Central Africa where we saw the highest HIV prevalence, but still only around 1 and below 5%. 10 years later, see what happened. It spread from Central to Southern Africa and all over the world. And even in the early days of AIDS, within a few years, about every single country in the world had reported people living with HIV or AIDS cases because there was no test for HIV. And the example of South Africa is typical, whereas in 85 there were very few people with HIV. 10 years later, it was one of the most affected parts of the world. And then further globalization in the 21st century, with now explosive epidemics, particularly in the countries of the former Soviet Union, and more in Asia as well. So a story of globalization, of a failure to control the epidemic in the early days. When we look at the at the same time, the growth of the number of people living with HIV and the response to it, and then we see that in the early days, the hallmark of the response was, on the one hand, scientific discoveries, as we just heard from Tony. The cause was identified, first blood test and so on. Community response was the first evidence in the gay community, was the first evidence that this is a problem that we can really bring under control, if the will is there. And that happened in the Western world. The global network of people living with HIV was actually founded before the international organizations created in 86 the Global Program on AIDS with Jonathan Mann. And the historic significance of Jonathan in the response to AIDS is emphasis that we have to embed the response to AIDS in a human rights approach and not in a classic quarantine type of approach in the response to AIDS. He really set the tone for the years to come. The global program on AIDS was created in a time that there was massive, massive denial, particularly in the worst affected continent in Africa. This is from the first meeting that WHO organized on AIDS in Brazzaville in 86. You can see Jonathan Mann, plus a number of members from Project SIDA in Kinshasa, which identified most of the elements that are still being the hallmark of the epidemic in Africa. The epidemic following the creation of GPA continued its expansion, and what we're seeing is a number of things. One, you see the curve, the lower curve is a third wave of the epidemic. First wave is HIV infection. Second wave, people are developing AIDS. And the third wave is children orphaned by AIDS, which starts appearing in the 90s as a major problem, but which was only really documented by the end of the 90s. Uganda and Thailand are in the early 90s the first countries, developing world, where we see a decline in new infections as a result of government and community-based led programs. 10 years ago, as we all know, HART was described for the first time in Vancouver, and in my speech at the opening ceremony there, I already said that I'm very concerned what will happen for the poor people in poor countries. And it's only a few years later that Brazil started as the first developing country to offer antiretroviral therapy to all its citizens free of charge, which was a hallmark, the response, a courageous decision at a time when there was not one donor who was in favor of antiretroviral therapy, with the exception of France, I should say, and where we were at an all-time low in terms of political mobilization. That changed rapidly in the early 2000s. Here you see a curve with total annual resources available for AIDS between 86 and 2005, in other words, last year. And what you see is really an acceleration in after 2001, after the special session of the UN General Assembly with the creation of the Global Fund, of US PEPFAR, and a major increase in funding available. That was only possible because of the groundwork that was done in the years before. And that's a lesson for the next 25 years as well. Key elements, I believe, were the fact that, particularly in Africa, the leadership started to recognize that AIDS is affecting the economy, is affecting society, and that leaders were personally affected. Because up to now it was researchers from the developed countries who draw attention to AIDS. Secondly, debate in the UN Security Council and the special session in the General Assembly elevated the problem from a problem dealt with by ministers of health to heads of state. And then we had a change in coalitions. When in Durban in 2000, I called to move from the M word to the B word, from millions to billions when it comes to funding. I got phone calls from high-level officials from development agencies saying that somebody in my position should not make that kind of irresponsible statements and that the money is not there anyway. Today we are at $8.3 billion. Now, before I close, two things. The last several years, we've made more progress in the developing countries in terms of the response to AIDS than the 20 years before. The facts are there. We see a decline in HIV prevalence, particularly new infections among young women in many countries, Africa, some Asian countries or states, and in the Caribbean. We heard 1.6 people on antiretroviral therapy. All this is basically definitely not enough, but there are real results which show that it's possible. And positive things have happened, and we must recognize these, and that they show that we can reverse this epidemic. We can only guess what would have happened if these billions would have been available 10, 20 years ago. And actually, with probably a few billions, we could have really stopped this epidemic and nipped it in the bud. That illustrates how important it is to act early and to build the political will. In conclusion, for the next 25 years, as I said in my opening speech, and as is also on the cover of the red issue of The Lancet, a bit for publicity for Richard here, that the fundamental challenge we face now is to sustain and increase a full-scale AIDS response over at least another generation, and hopefully not more than that, which will require leadership, funding, making the money work, social change as the second leg we walk on besides scientific evidence and research and development. And the next few years are going to be crucial. Shall we ride on the wave of initial and small successes now, or shall we give up? Will there be complacency? And therefore, it will be important for the next few years, at least, to maintain the exceptionality of AIDS, but linking it at the core of development agendas, not outside. We're not near the end, and the next years, again, are going to be crucial. And this is what I believe should be the core of our discussions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. Hydea Broadbent is director of Hydea and Friends. Hydea was diagnosed with HIV when she was 3 years old, and she was told that she would not live past the age of 5. And after a life of remarkable commitment and achievement as an AIDS activist and educator, she founded Hydea and Friends only 5 months ago. Hydea and Friends is dedicated to providing young people with a clear understanding of how to avoid at-risk behaviors. Hydea, we're glad that your physician was so wrong those years ago, and you're very welcome here at this conference.
I started speaking when I was about 4. I was a patient at NIH, and a lot of my friends weren't public with the fact that they were infected. They didn't tell their grandparents. They couldn't tell their best friends. And I didn't understand why. I was a very outspoken child. I never held anything back. And that's why I began speaking, because I wanted everyone to be treated as we should, with respect. Now I talk to youth, especially my peers, about safe sex and the type of activities that they're partaking in, what the results may be. I just want everybody, especially parents, talk to your children. That's the most important thing, I think, when dealing with HIV/AIDS, is communication. Because without that, kids, we're going to be left in the dark. And if our parents aren't talking to us, then we're talking to our friends. And majority of the time, our friends don't know what they're talking about. So just, it's important for us to know what's going on. Don't ever try to hide anything from your kids, especially when dealing with sex, because we listen to music, and we watch TV, and we watch videos. Sex is all around us. There's no hiding it. So talk to your kids. I think it's important that everybody know that your kids, we're the future. We really are. And if we're not educated, I don't think we're going to have a bright future. My parents were told when I was 3 that I wouldn't live to see 5, and I'm 22. I'm a college student. I'm a college student, I date, I plan on getting married and having kids. There's a bright future out there. But I wouldn't know about my future if my parents didn't educate me, if the doctors didn't educate me. So everybody, if you have a voice, use your voice to educate the next person, because the word is important for people to know. It's important to know what the future holds for someone who's infected with HIV/AIDS. Thank you.
Hi, dear. Thank you so much. Greg Gonsalves is coordinator of the Regional Treatment, Literacy and Advocacy Program of the AIDS and Rights Alliance of Southern Africa. Greg's worked on behalf of people living with AIDS since 1990, and he's going to give you in 7 minutes his perspective of the next 25 years.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'll try to make this quick. Peter Piot told the New York Times earlier this year that 2005 was the least bad year in the history of the AIDS epidemic. But I'm telling you today that we are losing the struggle against this disease. 5 million new infections last year, 3 million dead, among them 500,000 children gone. It was the worst year yet for those we've lost. In 7 minutes, I can't make a comprehensive analysis of what's happened to us over the past 2.5 decades, so I'll make 3 quick points. First, I'd like to refer you to a book that has nothing to do about AIDS. It's called Famine Crimes by Alex DeWall. He's talked about how the humanitarian aid industry has worsened and perpetuated famines, particularly in Africa, and it provides an analytical framework through which we need to interrogate our AIDS work. I talked about this a long time ago in Bangkok, 2 years ago, and I don't have time to elaborate on it today, but I want to talk to you very quickly about the bottom lines. I think we've created a vast infrastructure that is largely unaccountable, self-justifying, pursuing organizational survival and expansion, privileging the policy occupations of the major industrialized countries, privileging generalized international responsibility instead of specific local political accountability, privileging technical experience and skill over local knowledge, and promoting development or assistance instead of social change. No wonder things aren't getting better. We've created a system that's designed to fail. Yet in the margins of the system, there remain men and women, yes, heroes for some of us, who are largely forgotten, unknown, ignored, or reviled by those who make this machine run. It's not Bill Gates or Bill Clinton who've made the difference in this epidemic, despite their welcome to this meeting as some sort of royalty. The seduction of money and power, that they represent have blinded us to what they've really delivered to us. The real heroes are people like Christopher Maraca, Dasha Otriet, Paul Kasana Kimona, Thomas Kai, Loon Gangte, Rajiv Kafal, Michael Callan, Scott Slutsky, Sunil Pant, millions of people that I cannot describe here, all of whom have changed and some who are still changing the world, often at great personal risk, while you were looking elsewhere and took no notice of them. Second, we need to reinscribe the fight against AIDS as part of a larger movement for social and economic justice. Our heroes knew and know this. It's no surprise that where we find AIDS, we find other infectious and chronic diseases like TB, diabetes, obesity, heart disease, asthma, mental illness, and social epidemics like crime, violence, and poverty. Unless we start looking at the factors, the root causes that drive health disparities, and otherwise why some of us get sick and some of us don't, we will always be treating one illness while the patient dies of another. It's no coincidence that these multiple epidemics exist among marginalized communities across the globe, among the poor, women, drug users, sex workers, gay men, prisoners, migrants. The social, economic, and political policies that create this marginalization in the first place also push us into the path of oncoming epidemics. Yet we place our hopes in prevention programs that narrowly construct risk around individual behavior or in some new technology that will save us. Even those who profess to be deeply concerned about HIV prevention, like Mr. and Mrs. Gates, have little stomach for facing the structural and environmental factors that are the fuel for this great fire of an epidemic, and they watch the flames grow because to act on these issues moves beyond charity and into the realm of politics. That brings me to politics. We have to repoliticize AIDS. There are dear colleagues like Edwin Cameron and Zach Yockmott in South Africa, and those I respect like Kevin DeCock and Tom Frieden in New York City, that have made the case we need to de-exceptionalize and re-medicalize AIDS. I agree that we need to rethink HIV testing and that accepting that millions of people live and die without knowing their HIV status is totally unacceptable. I support making HIV testing easier to do, integrating sound evidence-based public health strategies into our approach to AIDS, and integrating HIV into strengthened systems of care and prevention for infectious and chronic diseases in general. However, the presumption by Kevin DeCock in particular that we need to abandon a rights-based approach to HIV/AIDS in order to do so is frankly reactionary and just plain wrong. The calls to de-exceptionalize AIDS and return it to its proper medical context can easily become calls to turn us back into patients and victims, passive actors in the epidemic. No doctor likes patients who talk back, and either do governments. They can become calls to ignore or downplay the social or economic aspects of HIV that I just referred to above, and push AIDS back into the realm of medicine, where the solutions are only biomedical. They can become calls to make AIDS as unexceptional as all the other ills, both medical and otherwise, that affect our communities, when we should be claiming that health for all and social and economic justice is a human right. I know it's unfashionable these days to talk about rights, and particularly then to fight for them as if one really meant them. AIDS is essentially a crisis of governance, of what governments do and do not do for their people. We have the drugs to treat HIV infection. We have the tools to confront the risks that drive HIV transmission and prevent infection itself. What we don't have is national political will. We've demanded too little from our leaders and excused too much. Except for the cries of a few brave activists, most people in countries around the world affected by the epidemic have not risen to hold their governments to account, to say these are our rights and these are your obligations. Even well-established movements like the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa consist of only a few thousand people and struggle for funding. How can this be? Why aren't there millions of people around the world demanding action or telling their leaders to stand down? I know it's hard to... Some of us work in places where political action is difficult or impossible, but it's possible in more places than you think. The sad fact is that some of us with resources, the ability to change things ourselves, have a real inability or a blindness to see what the epidemic is, see the epidemic for what it is, a political crisis, or we've made a decision to do so because complicity with the systems of power that perpetuate and worsen the epidemic is easier for us. We're in a terrible anti-political moment right now, where the powers that be have taken our rhetoric and told us that everything is fine, we're on your side, you can demobilize and leave the epidemic to us. That is the pernicious message of this conference. Don't believe a word they say. It's been the worst year of the epidemic for so many of us. The question is whether we're going to stand up and make a promise today, as one of my heroes, the late great Vito Russo, did back in 1988. He said, "We're so busy putting out fires right now that we don't have the time to talk to each other and strategize and plan for the next wave and the next day and the next month and the next week and the next year. And we're going to have to find the time to do that in the next few months. And we have to commit ourselves to doing that. And then after we kick the shit out of this disease, we're all going to have to be alive to kick the shit out of this system so that this never happens again."
Greg, thank you very much for that. Elizabeth Madra is Program Manager of the AIDS Control Program in the Ministry of Health in Uganda. She joined Uganda's Public Health Service back in 1980, and she has more experience than any other panelist and many people in this room of the threat of AIDS on a continent that is most jeopardized by this pandemic. Elizabeth, we're delighted you made it through London. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak at this panel of the special session looking at the 25 years of the epidemic, reflecting back. And my topic will be particularly looking at the early developing countries in response to the epidemic. In my introduction, basically I'll focus on the presentation will be Uganda as a case early starter But that does not mean I'll not refer to the other countries in Africa. Comparisons also will be made with other countries which started responding to the epidemic as early as Uganda, a country like Senegal, and then those laid within the East African countries, which also do responded to the epidemic, like Kenya, Tanzania, and then also some countries in West Africa. And I'll also try to talk about the pillars of the responses, because we need to see where we really started from and where, what we did, the achievement we were able to make, and what happened, and what should be the way forward. As elements of the early response, we've had a high level of political commitment and support at the beginning. A country like Uganda, where the political support really helped the country to come out, but it also took a bit of time. Because if we look at when the epidemic was, the AIDS cases were first diagnosed in Uganda in 82, that means 5 years back, before we see the AIDS cases, could have been the time of the epidemic. But the East African countries, including Uganda, had a silence. Nobody talked about it until 86, when we had a change of government, and that's when the response was really immediately made. And I do remember at our early, the World Health Assembly, when the health minister of Uganda mentioned about the HIV and AIDS being in Uganda, it was really like a tragedy and taboo. And of course, the earlier interventions were basically focusing on awareness creation. And these were based on interventions being developed through the global program on AIDS, not really based country specific. Later, prevention was also focusing on behavioral change, individual behavioral change and communication advocacy. Here now we are looking at whether this should not be done really as a process. And then, of course, counseling on positive living. Because there was no treatment, people were dying, people were being stigmatized, and an earlier country responding to this was again Uganda, with formation of the AIDS support organization, TASO, which looked basically at caring for these people in the home, palliative care. And of course, of the epidemic nature, which was basically looking at the health-related issues, most of the HIV-AIDS programs were in the health sector. And this was through the global program on AIDS. And indeed, later on, we had to look at the pillars of the national responses. The multi-sectoral approach started, decentralization of implementation, public-private partnership, involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS as a GIPA principle, openness of the policy, and then also effectiveness of the coordination. And these were basically to see how best we could reach with an intervention program and try really to fight this epidemic equally. So achievements were made for some extent because of all the strategies which were developed. We saw declining trends of the HIV in Uganda. Other countries like Zambia also started reporting, and Senegal, and followed by a few other countries. Commitments from leaders were shown to an extent. And then also, over time, we see all these commitments were beginning to relax. We saw complacency. What could have led to that? Is it the praises we are getting for having done very well in terms of leadership commitment? What could have been the reason? Now we see for the last 3 years, Uganda has also stagnated with this decline trend. Our prevalence stands at 6.4% in the general population. We have antenatal also stagnated at 6.5%. No more countries are reporting any decline trends. So that means something is happening. The epidemic has stagnated in Africa, and you've seen also from the presentation, Africa still bears the brunt of the epidemic, which means enough is not being done. So we need now to change our strategy. There has to be a different groups in the population who are affected, who needs to be really addressed. The gender issue has come out very clearly. We need to address the gender issue, the violence which is happening, the age group. We've seen young people not being well targeted, and they are being denied information, and they are not being talked about sex and sexuality, and they are not being even talked about condoms in many of the situations, especially in the schools. This really have to be changing. We have conflicts. We are not addressing HIV within the conflicts. And also there are so many areas which are affected due to conflicts, internally displaced people. We need to talk about income levels. The Uganda Sero Survey has already shown that the increased infection among women is also related to their wealth. And this needs to be addressed. These are new issues. Risk sexual behaviors, the condom use, which is still low, need to be promoted. We have lack of control of barrier methods for women, and this has been well articulated in this conference, the issue of microbicides, which is really being talked about. Despite all this, we need also to look at the issue of discordant couples. These are things which are really coming up and is not being addressed. 50% of that is being seen now in Uganda. So discordant couples is also another threat. We also need to have the issue of STIs. We are not talking anymore about sexual transmitted infections. In fact, this is now becoming also a threat. As a driving factor of the epidemic. Issue of HSV2, which is also being seen as a threat. We are not also addressing this. We are looking only at heterosexual, MSM, intravenous drug abuse, and then also commercial sex work. These are areas we need really to look around and address. And of course, what should be the way forward? I believe the best way forward will be now country-specific strategy based on the drivers of the epidemic being identified within the countries. We can no longer develop strategies which are universal. The countries need to identify the drivers of the epidemic and develop their strategic plan based on the drivers of the epidemic. The ABC strategy is still relevant, but that does not mean we should not add other issues. We need to promote counseling, and then also we need to scale up testing and counseling. As I conclude, this epidemic will never end until we equally address it. It should not look like the African epidemic. It should not look like the East European epidemic. It should not look like the Asia epidemic. Unless we equally address the epidemic as it is, whether we control it in Europe, if Africa still remains as it is, then the epidemic will never be defeated. I thank you for your attention.
We have 15 minutes to have some discussion. And I'm going to put one or two questions to our panel and see how we go. But we will finish at 2:15. I'd like to begin, if I may, with Hydea. Hydea, you spoke passionately and movingly about the inclusion of youth in our conversation regarding HIV/AIDS. In your experience, how do we draw out the voice of younger people more?
I think it's important for us to talk with them, not preach to them. A lot of times we feel that, well, you feel that adults are telling them what to do. And for kids, like, people always say, well, how do we educate our youth? How do we get our youth more involved? Do things that they're interested in. Have a conference like this, but have people that, actors that care about this disease, rappers that care. I just started doing a lot more work with the hip-hop community because their lyrics are so strong within the youth that the youth listen to everything that they say. So we have to get the singers and the rappers that care about HIV/AIDS to step up to the plate and say, yeah, I sing about this, but I also live a positive lifestyle. So, I mean, the youth care. They don't really know a lot, but they care. And I think we really need to put more faces of people that look like them, that have the same interests as the youth, that are doing the same things, to let them know that, you know, anyone can become infected. We need to put a face that they can recognize to AIDS.
Elizabeth, the future of the epidemic in Africa is similarly going to depend on an engagement with younger people. What's your experience of engaging younger people in an African context?
In Africa, the young people engagement has been even early in the response of the epidemic. We value the young people because they are the future and they are the leaders of the future. And if we do not prepare them and give them that hope, to achieve the goals they set, then we will not have done our jobs. We've got the young groups, the young positives, and then the youth groups who are helping, basically in supporting each other, working out peer groups. In terms of resource allocation, we try also to target programs which actually address the epidemic among the young people, even to an extent of trying to introduce also the condom use for the young people, although not quite many in schools. And indeed, our programs have shown that the interventions for the young people have really worked very, very well. And we believe that in future, we'll try also and introduce HIV/AIDS education in the secondary education. At the moment, the primary level education has some curriculums which are also targeting the young people and looking at a lot of areas of intervention for the young people, especially looking at prevention of HIV infection.
Thank you. Greg, while you were speaking, you didn't know that we were taking a poll in the audience. And even though you've moved to South Africa, we've just elected you President of the United States. You take over office tomorrow morning. What are you going to do about HIV/AIDS?
Really? Well, look, we can first start with making needle exchange legal and federally funded. We can get rid of abstinence-only sex education programs. We know they don't work. We can have national health care. The rest of the industrialized world has national health care. We have none of it. I'm living in South Africa, but in the U.S. we have a country that is destroying what we set up under the New Deal and the Great Society programs and throwing the poor to the wolves. And basically, if I was president, you know, we would have national health care, we have evidence-based HIV prevention policies that would do a start to controlling the AIDS epidemic. Then we have to address violence against women, epidemics of drug use, and other things that I described in my talk. But that's not the way my country sees fit to deal with people living with AIDS or other people dealing with infectious and chronic diseases.
Thank you. I hope you're going to stand. Tony, I had a message come through while we were on the panel to say that Warren Buffett's changed his mind about where he's spending his money. And he's taking it away from the Gates Foundation, he's giving it to NIAID. So you've suddenly got a huge injection of cash. What are you going to spend it on?
Thank you, Warren. We have a spending plan that obviously, unfortunately, has been flat for the last 3 years, as has the funding of all of the institutes, cancer, heart disease, and lung, all the other diabetes. What I would do certainly is that there are many areas that there are still gaps. We certainly need to have prevention research continue to be accelerated. Topical microbicides is one of them. The other is vaccine. We still have to crack the vaccine issue. I don't think a vaccine is in the cards over the next few years, but I think it won't be unless we really accelerate our scientific efforts in that direction. And also to make sure we have a robust pipeline of antiretrovirals. We've made major advances, the whole field, in going from 35 pills a day to one pill once or twice a day. To me, that's a major advance, but we've got to do better. We've got to get integrase inhibitors. We've got to get the maturation inhibitors. So there are a lot of things we need to do. We could spend the money if somebody wants to give it to us.
Okay. Now, Peter, you're a global ambassador for HIV/AIDS. To me, you are the conscience of our community. What keeps you awake at night?
It does keep me awake at night. It's only AIDS that keeps me awake at night. It's a combination of the fact that, as Einstein said, you know, it's not enough to see, to have eyes to see, to have ears to hear, and that even today, that it's not fully understood that AIDS is an altogether different league. I'm getting very upset when it suggested, okay, let's integrate AIDS into everything that there is there. I mean, the points that that Greg also made and that I made in my opening speech. I'm very concerned about that, about the long-term future. I'm concerned about two things also: that how can we make sure that everybody who needs this has access to treatment and that we have widespread prevention efforts, but also how can we make sure that 10, 20, 30 years from now that is still going to be the case? And we don't talk about that. I think there is denial about the fact that this is a long-term issue and that we need therefore to change some of the ways we're approaching this. What keeps me also awake at night and what keeps me angry is that where we have scientific evidence, that's not being used. I mean, Tony said it, Greg said it, that goes from harm reduction programs to promotion of condoms. And what keeps me also awake at night is the fact that we are blind for the drivers of this epidemic. That if we are not going to deal with the gender issues, I mean, what Elizabeth said, the issues, the drivers, some of the social injustice and inequality issues, we have no chance to stopping this epidemic, even with a vaccine, because the vaccine will not go where it's needed. So the challenge for AIDS is really a political one, a social one, and a scientific one, and we've got to really invest in all three. And that is not happening. And there are many more things that keep me awake at night. Every time that Greg sent me an email, whenever I get an email from Greg, then, no, that's not
I'm going to turn to our two chairs now. They didn't get away. Helene, you've led the International AIDS Society with devotion and commitment, and we've all been impressed by that this week, and thank you for your enormous contribution. But you're moving on. You're moving on to a new job, which is going to put health in a wider development context. What lessons are you going to take away from your time working in HIV/AIDS to your new role in this much broader agenda, which is about solving some of the really big problems in the world that include HIV/AIDS but go beyond it?
Thank you, Richard. I think some of the things that several people have said are the kinds of things that I hope to be able to work on. I think, first of all, the issues that CARE and other development agencies work on are those underlying drivers. They're the reasons that many of us went into health and addressing health as a social inequity to begin with. They are issues of poverty, gender inequality, lack of access to education, and other basic services, but they're also the underlying issues, political issues of good governance and other issues that are so critical, keeping our policymakers accountable for the needs of their citizens. So I think there are all of those issues that we look at, and how, not only how do we empower women, but how do we make sure that societies recognize the importance of women and the context of women within society. So all of those are the kinds of issues that I think have to be integrated if we want to make a difference in HIV or have an impact on poverty. But I think some of the things that Peter said are critical. These kinds of issues are long-term issues, and if we think about them only as things that we want to solve quickly and then move on, we're not going to have the impact we want. So to have an impact on poverty, we know that this is tough, it's difficult work, but it's long-term. To have an impact on HIV and other major issues that are driven by social inequities, we have to make sure that we stay in it for the long haul and look at these things in integrated fashions and not take them as one-off issues.
Helene, thank you, and we wish you well in your new role. Mark, we've been impressed by your not just scientific and clinical leadership, but your political leadership this week, and your honesty and bravery in talking about a lack of leadership in our host country for this conference. What do you believe the rich countries of the world can do more to demonstrate their commitment to translate rhetoric into action to defeat AIDS?
Well, I agree. We need more political leadership. We need the willingness of leaders to be outspoken on HIV as a leading issue of the day. And all too often we find that the HIV agenda simply gets sidetracked by some bomb that explodes somewhere in a train station. And despite the damage that bomb does, it's still very minor compared to the numbers of people who will die that very same day due to HIV/AIDS. It's almost as though the HIV/AIDS agenda has become vulnerable itself to virtually anything else that happens around the world. And I find this very sad. I wish I had answers to how we could continue to keep HIV/AIDS on the front pages of our newspapers around the world on a daily basis. Clearly, part of the problem is fatigue, but I think we have to find ways of overcoming that. But I really wanted to make another point that I don't think it's been addressed on this panel. You know, I'm an optimist, and I really look at the future, perhaps because I do work in a lab setting and do try to address issues that will hopefully result in newer and better drugs. I really see two huge developments moving forward. First, I see us having access to rapid HIV screening tests within a very short period of time. And I think these really will have the opportunity to change the global perspective on how we look at HIV. Some of these really have exquisite sensitivity and specificity. Imagine sitting in a doctor's office for only 15 or 20 minutes before you get your result, instead of being told, come back in 3 weeks and we'll let you know whether or not you're positive. And that's a horrendous situation that people have to deal with right now. So if we could turn that around and give them a rapid answer with counseling in the context of a short office visit, we'll have made enormous progress both here in the rich countries of the world, but more importantly as well throughout the developing world where the problem is more urgent. And I agree with Dr. Fauci. The new drugs that are coming forward just really seem fantastic. And, you know, if there were time, I would want Dr. Fauci to tell us about whether he thinks some of these new drugs have the chance really to improve treatment and make a difference into the future, because not only are they great antiretrovirals, but maybe they're going to affect the ability of HIV to get integrated into the reservoirs. I think that's a key issue that scientists now need to engage in a major, major way, and I'm optimistic we're going to really make progress on all fronts.
Thank you, Mark. Our time is up. What can we conclude from this panel? I think we can conclude that more of the same is not enough. We need a step change in the way we are tackling this pandemic, a different way of doing science, a different way of devising policy, and a different way of talking with one another, respecting one another, valuing one another, creating an inclusive and authentic society. That must be the litmus test for Mexico. Thank you for coming this lunchtime. Please thank our panel. Travel safely. Love beautifully.